Welcome to the Film Experience podcast. This is a special edition, the SmackDown of 1972. We're looking at the Oscar race for Best Supporting Actress. And I'm very excited to reintroduce a panel who you've already read about. We have with us Donna Lynn Champlin, award-winning actress, just finished the final season of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And that's a show which fearlessly looked at mental health issues, complex relationships through a musical comic lens. And I think all of those things would probably be coming useful to read these crazy movies.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, it was quite a trip. Every movie was its own special thing. And I can't wait to talk about it. Right.
And we have Kathy Deitch, a stage and screen actress and co-host of Plus This Show. You may have seen her in Wicked and Footloose on Broadway, or as the young bearded lady on American Horror Story Freak Show. Not everybody can say that they played Kathy Bates or a variation thereof.
You know, and what's crazy is that I've done it twice.
What?
Yes, I actually have been working on a musical that is a spoof of the movie Titanic, and I get to play.
Stop it.
I swear to you. And it's probably one of the reasons why I got the job. But yes, yes.
That's
Hi,
amazing.
It's great to be here. These movies are bananas, and I have so many thoughts. I can't wait.
Next, we have Sri Lankan playwright, actor, and director Arun Wendelawe Pramatilake.
Almost.
His most recent play, The One Who Loves You So, was just shortlisted for the Gracian Prize, which was originally founded by Michael Ondaatje of the English Patient fame. So congratulations.
Thank you. And yeah, it's such an honor to be on the podcast. I'm so excited. And yeah, the films are absolutely cuckoo. So yeah, cannot wait to get in.
Yeah. And then we have Eric Bloom, who works in television as a writer-director, and you've also read him here on the Film Experience several times.
I've also played a young Kathy Bates. I could do it.
You mock my livelihood.
And I am, of course, Nathaniel Rogers, your host at the Film Experience, a film blogger, actress obsessive, and I love watching old movies and trying to place myself in the mindset of those years, which can be a challenge, as with these movies. First of all, I'm wondering if any of you had seen these movies before. I'd only seen Butterflies Are Free and The Poseidon Adventure, but the others were new to me.
And I hadn't seen any of them. I'd seen clips of The Poseidon Adventure, usually in some sort of mocking format on television. But I had not seen any of these movies, and it was really, I felt like I kind of got into like a time machine and couldn't get up and got scared.
Same, exactly the same. And I'm such a Shelley Winters fan, and I'm so embarrassed that I hadn't watched The Poseidon Adventure, but yeah, I hadn't seen any of them all the way through either.
Mm-mm. All right. I'd seen clips of The Poseidon Adventure. I think I've started to watch The Heartbreak Kid about 15 times before I finally sat down to do it, managed to finish it. And I've seen Butterfly. And Butterflies Are Free, I had seen when I was younger, because for some reason it was a staple on television in Sri Lanka for a little bit. But yeah.
Oh, that is the definition of random.
Yeah,
I was obsessed with The Poseidon Adventure when I was little, because you used to have to watch movies on TV with commercials when I was growing up, and Poseidon Adventure was always on. And like, as a young boy, that idea of the ship being turned upside down is so cool. And of course, now watching it, there's two or three scenes where they have set design purposefully, like the bathroom scene. But like most of it, the whole movie, you're like, that isn't what it would look like if it was turned upside down.
That is not how any of that would look.
No. They have two scenes that are like purposefully designed set wise to be the upside down sets.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Otherwise, the whole thing is like, that's not true. It's not true. Exactly. For a second.
Especially with the like staircases.
Yes.
So I assume everybody was familiar with Shelley Winters, of course, and Eileen Heckert. But Susan Tyrell, I only knew from John Waters' Crybaby. So that was that was a jolt to my system.
Ah, right.
I don't know where I know her from. Maybe it is Crybaby. Maybe it was just that it was so close to home, like with my alcoholic fam. I felt like I really knew who she was. Like I was like, I know that person.
The most sort of like voyeuristic performance, the one performance out of all of them that I actually felt like I was watching a real person as a voyeur. She was actually my favorite. Mm-hmm. I thought she was stunning.
Well, I guess this would be the time to say that she actually tied with Eileen Heckert, so we have two winners.
Oh,
yeah. Between us?
Yeah. And the last panelist, all of us, and the last panelist is the collective voice of the readers. And they also tied there somehow with all of those votes.
Oh. Really?
Yeah. I mean, Susan Tyrell's performance was more polarizing, but Eileen consistently pulled very, like, high or above average.
Yeah.
Butterflies Are Free, lady?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you were less of a convert to her, Donna, than everyone else.
Mm-hmm. But I want to hear what everybody has to say, though.
Yeah.
Before I come in and smash everyone's dream.
Well, in terms of Eileen Heckert, I love what Eric and Arun, what you both said about her, and you both said something similar about there's a certain canned quality that she's maybe had these conversations before that comes from the fact that she has actually played the part many times. And Arun, you wrote, Heckert having given this performance many times, there's a sense that both mother and son have done this dance before. The circumstances change, but the conversations never do, which I thought was a great way of putting it.
Heckert really works for me because it does feel, I mean, the film is inherently sort of stagey, though that's not something that really annoys me about cinema. And I kind of get annoyed when people do use that as a criticism of theatrical adaptations. But I found it, really, there was something, yeah, sort of wrote about how she knew exactly how she was going to deal with her son, how she has this idea of exactly how she's going to deal with Horn's character. There was such a familiarity, which I thought really worked, that the character's never that surprised either. She's always anticipating until right at the end in the car with Goldie Hawn, I thought. And I thought I was impressed because it's a tough role in that the film really wants all of its characters to be heroes, so she just has to have this kind of turnaround at the end, which kind of seems a little silly. I found that she was meeting those challenges or finding kind of interesting ways into playing those parts.
I loved her presence, and I thought it was really interesting balancing a film performance and watching her do those close-ups that were so... And just, like, her comedy within the frame, like... I felt like she was so clear and like when she just wouldn't move a muscle and like let everything happen. I think that's really a hard adaptation and very few people get to do it gracefully, like go between film and theater, especially when you've played a part in both. It's funny because I guess I was like, oh yeah, it makes sense that she won more than it was the best performance for me. You know what I mean? Like it was a more substantial part. Like it she had a lot more to do. She could, like, get her teeth around some stuff. It wasn't just, like, a comedy bit and then we're done.
It obviously helps to have the biggest media
and it's
part.
A performance that...
Well, she has a diva intro, too. Like, it was the whole diva intro. She's facing away from us out of the mirror. You hear her voice first. The camera comes in. Like, that woman had a setup. Like, for me, unfortunately, I felt like the only way she could go was down. Like, it was such a high intro diva. Here she is, boys. And I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to see what's coming. And then for the whole movie, I was like, did it happen yet? Or I don't know. I was not a fan of this performance. I know I'm going to annoy you, Arun. I'm sorry. I just felt I felt like it didn't transfer. I'm so sorry. It felt like a... it felt like a theater performance on screen. And whether that's her or whether that's her director or whether she, you know what I mean? Like, you never know as an actress who's at the mercy of who. So I try to not be too, you know, you just never know. Or maybe it's editing. Who knows? But for me, it just felt really dry. It felt really technical. And I know the character is very, you know, methodical and there is a lot of repetition, but I couldn't see why this night was unlike any other. And, you know, I saw all of her clockwork and that just isn't something that I personally enjoy. I don't want to see anybody's technique. I don't want to see anybody's process. Even if it's part of the character to have that on film, I want to see somebody in between trapezes at some point. At some point, and I felt like I was just waiting for that moment. And the only moment where she was surprised, I didn't quite believe her. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Just going to say her voice for me is what did it. And I know, Kathy, you mentioned that her voice was to die for.
Yeah.
And I think she may have actually killed someone with that voice sometime in her life. So it's possible.
Yeah, I would not be surprised with it.
I thought every moment was ironed out and mapped out within an inch of its life, without question. But to me, it was that kind of performance that, like, Sally Field often gives, where you walk away and you're like, I don't know if she's a great actress, but she delivers. You know how, like, Sally Field, like, delivers?
Yes,
and,
true.
And you walk out of it being like, I don't love Sally Field as an actress, but every time I'm like, she knew what the scene was about as an actor. She got in there, she did it, and she made it land. And I thought that was like the Eileen Heckard thing, where it's like everything lands. But I agree that even like my favorite moment of hers in the movie is when Goldie Hawn says, oh, I was in the Mikado. I played Yum Yum. And she goes, I bet you did. It's a great line. She's so funny doing it. But even that moment,
right?
She's done 100 times just like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I wonder, what did you all think of that movie in general? Because I personally kind of loved it in a weird way. Like sorry, Donna. The metaphors are a little clunky, but in terms of like the wit of the script, there's a lot of good lines and all the characters are interesting, even though it's, you know, dated.
I thought it was the only movie of the five that was like a normal movie. So
yes.
To Kathy, to you, that's why I could see Eileen Heckard winning. It's a performance that particularly in 1972, people could wrap their arms around. They could understand it. Susan Terrell's way out there in outer space, and the other movies are so weird or there's not a lot. So it makes sense. Like Butterflies Are Free was just a very cute, satisfying, traditional little romantic comedy movie. And I don't think it's a good movie, but I wasn't mad at it.
Yeah. I literally feel the same exact way, especially after watching all the rest first and like squeeze Butterflies Are Free, like in at the last minute. I literally was like, oh, my eye knows this. Like, this knows what it wants to be. The rest of them really felt like they were experimenting with something and didn't land. And these relationship movies in the 70s are so fascinating. And I hope we can get into that. Like these couples, these heterosexual couples, like, and we're going to take a slice of their life and see where it goes. And it just was like, what is happening? Like, what, where is the spine of this? And I feel like because it's a play, we know the spine of Butterflies Are Free. And I did feel safe as a viewer. It was the one that made sense. It was like, oh, this has a structure. Like this, even though if I don't like where it's going, I know where, you know what I mean? I don't know. It was old reliable.
In those other movies, that the editing bay was all high, like in every single. I really feel Post was having many, many parties in 1972 on all the movies, except for this one. This one, they were all sober.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in a way also, it is that Butterflies Are Free is maybe in a weird way the least ambitious for what it's worth. I mean, not that it's certainly not, I don't think the other ones are all better by any means, but I do think it is simply trying to do something and it knows what it's doing very well. So therefore it is easily the most satisfying watch from start to finish. And it's the one where I didn't feel taxed for any reason, whatever that reason might be with the other ones. But and I do think Hecker, it's not necessarily the greatest performance, but again, like everyone's saying, it makes sense and it's clearly a great part. And I think also in a field like this, I felt like she rose to the top because she did seem like the one who'd really, who did have some sort of mastery of what she was doing, even if sometimes that wasn't as inspired as some of the other ones, maybe.
I feel like she made a one, because her character was the only one that wasn't tragic.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe her character out of all of them made people feel better just in the fact that out of all these women, her character was the one who had a proper arc, but also was the only one who also did not end literally in some sort of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know.
So in terms of this being 1972, I was wondering what you guys thought of the sort of references to the culture going on at the time. Like, there was weird queer jokes in this. Like, lesbians especially were the target of jokes, mm-hmm. like, that they were humorless, and yet gays were in. So there was some interesting things happening in this movie. San Francisco, 1972.
But I will say, that shirt that Edward Albert wears the whole second half of the movie, I have to get that shirt.
It's delicious. Yeah, it's absolutely so fantastic. I swear to God, all I could think when I looked at him, besides the fact that I actually loved him, he was my favorite by far in this movie, but he reminded me of the lead marionette in Team America. Did that happen to anybody else? I mean, I feel it like almost became a problem for me. And I was like, did they base the marionette on him? Or is it just coincidence? Or does he have just like that quintessential? I mean, it really took a lot of my brain space with the movie. I feel bad because I was a little bored. So, but
I would have to say, in terms of Edward Albert, the confusing thing for me that was taking up my mental space was that I was thinking of Eddie Albert, his father. Which is the one I knew. Yes, so I'm like watching the movie and I'm like, where's Eddie Albert? I'm like, this only has three characters. Where is Eddie Albert? You know?
Nice.
And then we ended up watching his father and the Heartbreak Kid for the same group.
Yeah.
I mean, how about all the issues all over the place in all the movies with gay people in general? Like, they want to be hip enough to talk about it, but then they talk about it. I mean, that character in Pete and Tilly,
who at the end... I had almost forgotten.
Oh my God, who asked her, listen, we could be together. I was like, what is happening right now? Like, what is happening? Like, because she, got into a fist fight on a lawn? Like, what is happening? Like... Oh my God! It was that was such a hard one.
That's what I was asking myself for. That literal entire movie, I was like, "What is happening?" In every scene.
Every scene
to watch. I was the sexism for me was really the hardest to sort of because I kind of feel like in a way, and maybe they were doing this, but like with the racism of the time and with the homosexuality, I felt like there was an effort to bring it forward because, hey, we're going to talk about it. But it really felt for me with the sexism, it was like they weren't even trying yet. Like, it was weird to me. Like, I was like, okay, are you acting this horrible sexist way because you're trying to say something? Or is it just, oh God, I think it's all just sexist.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. And fascinating that that the Heartbreak Kid, you know, directed by
Elaine May.
Thank you, Elaine May. I kept going, oh my God, really? Like, it really? This is like, I was really trying to find the female perspective. I was like, where is it? And honestly, I love Jeannie Berlin's performance so much in that
movie.
She's
amazing. Yeah.
And I said when I wrote to you, Nathan, like, I know her socially a little bit because she's very good friends with my very good friend. And, like, just knowing who she is now, which is, like, a whole thing. And then, like, knowing, like, watching her as that child. And then thinking about your mother being behind the camera. Like, I couldn't understand how she was actually doing it. And honestly, she was my tie for.
Yeah. Yeah, I had her up to the top.
Yeah, because she really, I just thought, there was something so honest and real and quirky, and yet she was hitting all those comic beats, and you have your mother behind the camera. Like, you should get an Oscar.
I never put that together. That's astonishing. I did not put together that it was her mother directing it.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I really wanted to like Heartbreak Kid more than I did. I really did. I mean, I have to say, through the whole movie, it left me with a feeling I liked, which was I thought it was really a disturbing movie. I liked the feeling of discomfort that I had watching it the whole time, but it just never transcended to me. It felt very, and I felt that way a bit even Jeannie Berlin. And I love Jeannie Berlin. She was just in The Night Of, that HBO miniseries.
She was great in that.
She was so great in it. But I thought she was great out of the gate when she's like, you know, when they're in the car and they're driving down and I thought she was great in those scenes, and I thought she was great in her last scene. But all the scenes in between that, she just had – it wasn't her fault. I just thought she had very little to do. She's in that hotel room, and it's kind of the same flavor of beats. And so the performance just never got to get to another level. It's not from her as an actor. I thought she did everything she could with that role, but it never got to take on a transcendent quality for me anyway.
My favorite performance in that movie was Eddie Albert's, because his line readings just made me laugh so much, and they were also my point of view when he was like, because I hate him about the groom.
No, I think Eddie Albert's such a relief in that film, because it's finally you're waiting for someone to say something about him, and finally somebody shows up at the end and actually calls him out, and you're like, oh, okay, they are at least somewhat aware of what has happened. But I found Heartbreak so tough because I was tonally, it seemed weird because in some points it does seem, it is horribly sexist, but at some points you're wondering, is it just that the tone is less aggressive and they are trying to do something where they're not placing judgment and they do know that the protagonist is a hideous human being, but that one was the one which I had the toughest feelings because it kept changing and shifting, whereas Pete and Tilly, I knew, was just like hot garbage from the moment.
Eric, I have to say, I disagree with you about Jeannie Berlin. I feel like the hardest part of her entire role were those scenes in between where she had to do some, like, I thought she was a master at active listening. Where for me, I felt like the script was, I mean, the whole thing, I mean, the sexism, again, is like, is the point to give him all the lines and have her not speak and have her have to do all of this really minor fine tuning without any lines? But I actually loved her performance because of those intermittent scenes where she's sitting in the hotel and you have to tell how much time has passed and how much more annoyed she is without giving her any words. And I just really felt like every time he came in and she was sitting on the bed, but she was sitting on the bed in a different way, or her tone of her voice was just a little more. And for me, I actually thought that was phenomenal, probably knowing that they shot it all out of order and that, you know, like, I just imagine like her and her script going, okay, 1 out of 10. So I'm at like a 3.3 right now and I have no lines. And so I'm going to have to, like, I actually loved her performance for the same reason you didn't love it, weirdly enough.
Our 25 year friendship is now over.
No problem while it lasted.
Yeah, I love this. I love when people disagree. Nathaniel, your point, that's what makes it interesting and fun.
Did Neil Simon write The Heartbreak Kid? I mean, like,
he did, yeah.
They had all the right pieces to make that something significant. And like something that at the end, you know, having that uncomfortable payoff. You know what I mean? Like, I like being uncomfortable in movies too, deliciously, horribly uncomfortable. But if the payoff is great.
I kept wondering, wait, who are we meant to sympathize with? And I realized that's reductive. I kept looking for the point of view, and I was really uncomfortable because for a while I thought, oh, it's actually on his side. And then later in the movie, when Cybill Shepherd gets more to do, and there's that moment where you kind of think, oh, she wasn't taking that seriously at all, and now he shows up in her hometown. But then even that didn't go the way I was expecting, and she just said, and then she just was in love with him all of a sudden. It was very confusing.
Again, post high as a kite. I really believe it. I feel like all those editing bays were just big, just rooms of smoke.
My problem with the comedy movie, The Heartbreak Kid, was I kept waiting to find the comedy. I just thought, I just thought it was not funny at all. And I thought, and I certainly think once Jeannie Berlin exits the movie at hour one, the last 45 minutes is a disaster. Couldn't have cared less. So certainly, she brings whatever humanity the movie has. She is the human element, which is funny because her character is also kind of awful, you know? And, but I still think she was the most human element and the only thing that was driving it. I like that she entered, I like when actors who are in a comedy have their characters approach life in a comic way, the way real human beings do, you know? And I think Berlin did have an element of that, that kind of like this character never, she doesn't, the only beautiful thing about Heartbreak Kid to me was that basically Jeannie Berlin to me was playing a character who just thought she was going to do the things you do in life, get married and have kids and have the life. She didn't think anything was ever going to really happen to her that was real. She didn't know that, but that was, I think, how she lived her life. And then, of course, when he leaves her, she becomes a person in that last scene. As, like, as hurt as she is, like, at least she's a human being now who's felt something real and unexpected. And that, so I thought her last scene was fantastic in that way. Like, I felt
he wanted to see that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to see that movie. I was like, what happens to her? I didn't give a fuck about the guy playing in, you know, with the Blue Bloods. I could have cared less. I'm sorry. I totally F-bombed. Sorry.
God, Kathy, how dare you?
No, please me. I'm
sorry. They're
going
to have to put a parental advisory on this.
But no, I wanted
all the little kids who are going to be listening to this.
Right. All those 1972 13-year-olds who are like, 1972.
If you look at that movie, Heartbreak Kid, as sort of the story of the Jeannie Berlin character who kind of comes into her own, as sad as that ending is, that to me is a nice story. And I think that's the part that Elaine May does get, and particularly gets because it's her daughter, a little bit.
Yeah, and I do wonder how much of that comes from the fact that, from what I read, then they didn't use much of Simon's script in the end. Well, there was sort of a war between her and between Elaine May and Neil Simon, and then at a certain point he decided to stop showing up to set so she would, because her style was more to improvise, and initially in his contract it says you can't change a single word, but then he stopped showing up so she would just record her versions of it. So the actual film that we're seeing is not necessarily the one that was written as well.
That could also explain, Donna, what you're joking about with in post, because it sounds like they made several different movies all at once.
See, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Post.
Although this conversation is making me think that I want to drop all of these characters into the Poseidon Adventure and
no,
see what
do
happens
to them. Don't do that to those poor characters. That's so mean.
Well, how would Lila have functioned in the Poseidon Adventure?
The director would have shown a lot of shots of her ass climbing stairs if she had been in it.
Oh, yeah.
Poseidon Adventure has a lot of hot girl ass in it, literally. It's like upstairs, up ladders. It's a lot of, and they're all in like mini skirts or short shorts.
Yeah, it's just one big wet t-shirt contest. So.
Yeah, it is.
How wet can we get everyone?
Yeah, and all
except for Shelley Winters, who has like her full gown on, soaking wet, like going through everything. Like she's also carrying 40 pounds extra.
All right, Kathy, can we talk like about the unicorn aspect of what they were trying to do with Shelley Winters in that movie?
She's a middle-aged woman who moves and climbs things. She's a unicorn.
She can hold her breath underwater.
My God. Women over 30 aren't supposed to be able to do that. How shocking.
I mean, God bless her. It got her a nomination, but I was like, why are we unicorning this poor woman? Middle-aged, plus-size women, like, do stuff all the time.
Yeah, oh. Kathy, I was actually thinking of you when I was watching this because of your show and all the jokes about, and then her even making jokes about her weight.
Oh, my God, the fat jokes. Oh, my God, every second.
It's absurd. But what's crazy is I know those people felt like they were really addressing something. It's like such a, the jokes also have this crazy condescension. Like, aren't we such good people? We're pointing out that she's fat and, like, that's a problem. Like,
she's really taking control and calling herself fat.
Yeah. What? There is something cool about her being the hero, though. I have to say that I did like that. I hate the way they got there, but I did like that she was the one, even though she had to get over all her fears. Oh, I'm useless.
Push me up the tree.
Yeah, her reaction to having her butt grabbed made me laugh a lot.
I mean, it's life or death. First of all, she can get up the fucking tree and we all know it. Second of all, don't push her. She's fine. It's life or death. She's going to get up it. Everybody relax.
Yes. And why? What are the weird priests that just show up in these movies?
Totally.
What is that about? There's like a real, and like Catholic priests, like just all of a sudden show up. Or no, the one was like a preacher guy, right? He was like a, oh.
Yeah, but
weird.
He was edgy. He'd been like excommunicated because he was cool.
I did think there was maybe, they were trying to maybe do some sort of thematic friction between the two priests about. Yeah. What they were
you
telling.
Think you're not sure? Is it subtle for you?
Well, it's
the
like
the fact that you're just one big sledgehammer, man.
Because of this group, I was also thinking of, and because Poseidon Adventure has had such a long life in the culture, I was thinking it's surprising that someone hasn't tried it in like theater, like
and Disaster the Musical.
It has been,
yeah.
Look at Seth Rudetsky. Prayers answered.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's absolutely fantastic. Seth Rudetsky wrote this amazing musical. Shout out to Seth Rudetsky. Called Disaster the Musical. I kind of want to say Jet Plotnick also had a part in it. I'm not 100% sure, but I really think he did. And it's hilarious. And it's basically, I mean, they don't call it the Poseidon Adventure probably because they don't want to pay copyright or whatever. But it's called Disaster the Musical, and it follows the Poseidon Adventure format, and it's absolutely hilarious, and it punches up every single joke that we're like talking about right now.
And
every
instead
single
of
one.
A priest, it's a nun. Yeah, it's like they do other things. But yeah,
the kids are used as props, you know. Mm-hmm. So like they, one of them is literally a doll because it doesn't matter. They don't need a personality. They just need to be a kid in peril, dramaturgically. It doesn't matter what kind of kid. Who cares?
Well, so we have the musical comedy, but we could also do immersive theater, choose your own adventure with Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah, butter tank. What?
That's funny your next assignment, Arun.
Yeah, I know. Actually, I think the first time I learned what the Poseidon Adventure was there was this awful, it's like a daytime soap opera in the States that they used to show on during the night here called Sunset Beach, which was the crudest, most awful, and it was absolutely fantastic. I loved it as a kid. And about 2 years into that, they did a like 10 episode arc, which is literally just ripping off every beat of the Poseidon Adventure. And that is how I knew it, except the priest in this one is like hot and he like sleeps with his brother's girlfriend during the wave, when the wave of ships capsizing and stuff like that. So that's really how I knew it first. So it does have a lot.
I did think they were going to go there with Pamela Sue Martin and Gene Hackman for a moment, because she was having some serious lust for the priest.
Yeah.
I was hoping something would happen. Here's my argument, though, is the acting in the Poseidon Adventure is so terrible that what Shelley Winters is doing is, like, subtle. That big,
exactly.
That big,
yeah.
Horrible acting she's doing in it is like, wow, compared to, like, Ernest Borgnine and Stella Stevens are so terrible in it, it's mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. Like, I can't even believe they let it out in a theater.
Well, even Gene Hackman, exactly. Who's usually so amazing.
Yeah. Gene Hackman is terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
I thought Shameless was kind of cute a little bit. He was the only one that didn't make me want to just, you know, literally push them overboard. He was cute.
They were all overboard.
I felt like he had levels.
Red buttons.
Yeah.
Oh, red buttons.
Is that romance? That was.
But yeah, she was like, in comparison, like every single actor was literally choking on the scenery. It was coming just pieces of wood just coming out of their bodies. And she was like,
exactly.
I'm going to get an Oscar nomination, bitches. Watch this.
Yeah.
But it's still remarkable because it's so anti what you expect from Shelley Winters. Because you expect her to be the biggest, and she went the opposite direction.
Right.
And that probably had a reasoning why she got the nomination, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this woman that you sort of laud as like this really hilarious comedian, this was her serious turn. I mean, like, that's what's so.
She played the game, man. She did it well.
Natalie, your point about trying to put yourself in 1972, The Side Adventure was a colossal hit. I mean, like, a Titanic like thing at the time. Yeah. And so you can see, like, I'm sure if we did Titanic 97. Like, if you go back and watch Gloria Stewart in that movie, she's terrible. She should never have been up for an Oscar nomination, but she was in that huge movie. She was like old Hollywood, blah. So that's how Shelley Winters got in there. You know, huge hit. And they were like, let's give it to the old lady.
I have
she came up and she swam. She swam. She's fat and she swims.
She dove in. Okay, but seriously, that dive was remarkable. And I rewound it many, many times to see if it was like a quick substitute of a stunt woman. And I was like, that is all her. I would give her the nomination just for that dive.
It is totally Shelley Winters, that
and
dive.
And she's like, juke. Like, I mean, perfect. I watched it a lot. I must have watched it at least 15 times. I was like, no way.
Since The Poseidon Adventure is such a camp classic and it has had such a long history, I was wondering what part you guys laughed hardest about in it, because I was laughing so hard at the reaction to the hit song from it, The Morning After, which was nominated for Best Original Song. And there's that one guy in the audience. There's that one guy in the audience who reacts to it like it's like industrial noise or punk rock. He's like, oh. And it is the lightest, most adult contempt, like easy listening song. And then when they
it's rock and roll, these kids and their rock and roll.
And then it gets even better. It's like the joke has an afterlife, because then when they sing it at the New Year's Eve party, people are dancing like it's like this disco hit. Even though it's like this really mellow, easy song. So any other things that cracked you up about it?
Oh, one thing?
I mean, it was just the ridiculousness at the end after Ernest Borgnine shouts at Gene Hackman, Gene Hackman shouts at him, Red Button shouts at somebody
else. Oh, my God, totally.
Literally shouting at God. And I was like, I could not believe it went there, that literally he's hanging to his death and he just starts shouting up into the sky. And I was like, what am I watching?
I want to know if Carol Burnett and he had conversations about their shouting to God scenes.
Oh my God, yeah.
Because Pete and Tilly, that's the worst part of Pete and Tilly. I was like, no, don't make her do this.
Which is saying a lot.
Yeah, that is saying a lot.
Pete and Tilly. Can we talk about Pete and Tilly?
Yeah.
It's super quickly.
Yeah.
Go, Eric, go.
What the living fuck? It's such a bizarre movie. And the weird thing is, you know, it was written by Julius Epstein, who wrote Casablanca.
Yeah.
So there are actually lines of dialogue in there that are super literate and kind of really kind of smart and lovely. Like, the dialogue is just like, the words are nice sometimes in a way that you don't see in screenplays. However, nothing makes sense. The characters are, I didn't even understand it. I don't know what happened. And she ends up in a loony bin at the end or something.
Because she got into a fist fight on the lawn?
No, what do they call it? What was it, a wellness center? What was the PC term for it? Because it was amazing.
Sanatorium?
I was like, what's happening?
And it almost seems like the gay man propositioning her is what leads her to go, you know what? I love my philandering husband who's never going to be here.
Oh, I know. That was so weird. Because honestly, if it had been me, I probably would have been like, I've been through too much. Let's do it. I mean, that is not a bad... Renee Auberjonois? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
I mean, he had a lot to offer, girl, except for, you know, and I'm sure he would have been, like, into an open relationship. He looks like the best husband in that whole movie.
Yeah.
Smart.
Yeah.
I was kind of surprised she turned him down because I was like, you're not thinking straight. Oh, I didn't mean that, but that's a bad thing.
Well, already at the beginning of the movie when it's like... I've been through it once already. This is tough, but I'm 33. Nothing. I was like, I am fucked. My single ass is fucked.
Oh, my friends are trying to set me up, and it's
33. I'm down the toilet. I'm giving up. I'm 33. I was like, wow. Okay.
Any reference to age in this movie freaked me out because it seemed like even in the other movies, too, it seemed like if you were over 30, it was, like, the end.
I know, but now, like, in Hollywood, if you're a woman, it's only bumped up to 40. So it's not really that much different. Yeah. I mean, you know.
At least they granted you 10 more years.
Oh, they did. Thanks, Hollywood.
Yeah.
Thanks.
But can somebody explain to me how Geraldine Page got nominated for that?
Because she's Geraldine Page. Anybody else would not have been nominated for that.
No. And Eric, I love what you wrote about the love and hate mannerisms of Geraldine Page, because I'm convinced after seeing several of her movies that she only had two modes, flat out genius and embarrassment. Like, every performance I've seen of her is either so fantastic, I can't believe it even exists, like Interiors or...
Trip to Bountiful.
Pope of Greenwich Village. Like, she's so masterful in some performances, and then other ones I'm like, I can't watch this.
You felt the paycheck written all over this performance, right?
Totally.
You want me for 3 days, how much money? Oh, I gotta have a fight with someone. You're gonna have to bump me up. I kept waiting because that one really felt the one that felt like the chore, right? Like that was the one where I was like, you guys really are making me do this. This is the chore. I said I would do it. And I was waiting. When is her Oscar moment gonna come?
Right.
I was like, what's the Oscar? And then when it was that, about her age, I was like, you have got to be kidding me. Like,
I mean, I've seen dinner theater performances of that same joke that were equal. Like, you know, where you just go.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
And why do you need Geraldine Page for that role? I am truly mystified by that nomination.
She had a walk-in closet she needed to get done, and that's how that happened. She needed to add onto her garage.
Maybe they let her keep the hats, as Arun mentioned. There was so much hat acting, you'd think she were at Ascot.
All that hat acting. Yeah. Hat acting, fork acting, literally eating food off her co-star's plate. I couldn't take it. And with that, with Pete and Tilly, and actually a lot of these films, it was so clear that they were all made by a certain generation of older white men who kept putting themselves against young women. So
Walter Matthau
is the equivalent to Carol Burnett. I mean, Red Buttons with that young woman in the Poseidon Adventure. It's that they literally, you can see how they perceive themselves. It was that to me was the most striking thing of, oh, this is how we change. This is, I can see a viewpoint of the world, like made very, very clear. And with the thing about Julius J. Epstein writing it, it just made me the first time really happy that the Hays production code existed for all those years in the 30s and 40s, because I just thought, oh, think of all the hideous stuff that it has actually prevented us from seeing, because those films we can watch without having to deal with these awful politics and how much they hate women, which is all I could think of with Pete and Tilly. Like, oh, you literally hate women.
Oh, God.
Like,
palpable. Palpable hatred. Yeah. Like, I watched it, and I needed, like, a silkworm shower afterwards. I couldn't. I just was like,
it's a gross movie.
Well, even the women in it hate women. or hate themselves, it seems like.
Yeah.
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 Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, no, no. A couple of, like, there's that, there is a really, Geraldine Page says it at the beginning of the movie about Walter Matthau, "I've never met a man with so many redeeming qualities." And Carol Burnett says, "Should a man need so many?" That is good writing. That's good writing.
It has like a vaudeville feel to it. Like, you know, there was like a definite tennis match, like, there was that, but it was contextually, like, but in the context of what it was, that dialogue, again, was horrifying. Like, it
was. But in what world do you put Carol Burnett and Walter Matthau together as a couple? Like, that alone makes me think that there was an expectation of the actors to fill in and shellac and scotch tape and, you know, as far as like, oh, they'll make it palpable because they're likable, funny people. And I feel like as actors, they looked at the material and went, oh, okay, this is my chance to sort of not be the clown and be like a real person. Yeah. And I think everyone was just sort of like, whoa, 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 wait, what, where's the juggling? Where's the, why aren't you smoke and mirroring this whole thing and making it funny?
Well,
like the whole process was conflicted.
Yeah. The humor was so deadpan at times that I think it was almost dead. Like I was like, pick this up, because there were some moments where I was like, oh, I get the comic tone Carol and Walter are going for, but in other times I was like, was that supposed to be funny?
Which you don't usually say
when you're watching Carol Burnett. You don't usually think, was that supposed to be funny?
I mean,
exactly.
For sure. And that scene where she's praying to God, I mean, I just, like, I've never, and that it's her, like, and that it's her that I'm doing this. I've never wanted to, like, sink within my sweatshirt and never come out. I was literally like, I want to hide away forever. This is horrible. It's bizarre to watch someone you idolize go through that. And yet refreshing that, you know, everybody has the thing that is not their sweet spot, I guess.
Everyone has their Pete and Tilly. I'm going to make a t-shirt for all of us.
Yeah. Everyone has their Pete.
Yeah. I survived Pete and Tilly.
The only 5 t-shirts ever produced.
It'll be worth it. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Okay, my favorite game I like to play about the SmackDown is, which of the 5 actresses do you think would have been most interesting in one of the other 5 actresses' roles?
Yeah, I saw that you'd ask that. I was thinking I would have loved to see a young Shelley Winters in a different version of Fat City. I thought there's something that excited me about thinking of her, where even in A Place in the Sun, which is obviously a very different performance, but that, or even her, she's not that much younger, but in Lolita, where there is something to her, kind of the way that her method, the way she is, like, she's kind of that emblem of the method in female actors and stuff at that time. And I thought it would be interesting to see what she could do with a role like that. And also because Winters also feels like an actor who was always hampered by the fact that she was working in a time when the parts that she was given were never that interesting. Not that I think that the part in Fat City is that great, but at least it has layers of darkness and depths of darkness, which maybe Winters didn't always get to play in the work that she's sort of known for in her heyday.
This was also my answer for many similar reasons. I think if Shelley Winters had been in a different era, she would have been perceived a lot differently, because she was obviously very talented. But people have this weird context of her as like this sort of joke in a way. Like, the Oscar presentation, which I think, Kathy, you mentioned, offended. I was like, why is Robert Duvall laughing when he reads her name?
What is this now? What happened?
When they presented the Oscar, they read the nominees, and Robert Duvall was presenting it, and he got to her name, and he just laughed all the way through her name.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Right before it was Susan Tyrell, Fat City, Shelley Winters. That's how it read.
Oh, that's horrible.
The audience was like horrified.
Yeah, there was nobody laughed. Nobody laughed. It was just Robert Duvall laughing to himself.
It was awful. It was really, and like, again,
it's very interesting, guys. And I mean, I'm going to bring it back to this because I do. But you see, like, when I hear people say stuff like, oh, you know, Dietland or Shrill, the fat shaming in those things are so, like, it's so, like, over the top. Like, that never happens. Like, I literally am like, no, all of those things and more have happened to me, mm-hmm. literally. And I'm a size 16. Like, not even talking about people who aren't, like, Lane Bryant fat, right? Like, mm-hmm. people who, like, can't buy clothes in, like, plus-size stores. So, and that is such a perfect example. She is nominated for the highest honor in film acting and still the butt of a fat joke by one of her peers. Like, it was really, really hard. It was hard to watch it. And just to see her sweet face just, like, literally collapse. Like, yeah, it just – it's really sad. And so I want Shelley Winters to play all the parts. Mm-hmm. I want her to play Goldie Hawn in Butterflies. I want her to have all the parts. But also Jeannie Berlin, too. Where did she go? Like, I'm mystified by why that performance didn't inspire people to do, like, other Oscar award deserving things. I just thought she was so extraordinary.
She was phenomenal.
And, yeah. And, you know, she could have played that Goldie Hawn part if someone didn't need somebody to be, you know what I mean? Like, so Goldie Hawn.
Mm-hmm.
That would be interesting.
I would like to see Eileen Eckhart play Susan Tyrell's role because I want to see her get loose and I want to see her sloppy. Because I agree that she's a fantastic actress, but the thing is, like, I see her training and I see her technique, and maybe it's because I'm an actress, Kathy. You might have the same problem. Is, you know, once you know how to play an instrument, you never really look at it a different way. Like, I never learned how to play strings because I love strings so much. I want them to be magic.
Right.
Once you study something, it's very rare that it's magic again because you know how the sausage is made. And I would love to see Eileen Eckhart in a role like Susan Tyrell's, where it's just all skin and flesh and no bones. I would love to see her sloppy. That would make me happy.
Had she ever done anything? I mean, she has done so many things. Did she do anything like that when she was younger?
I'm sure she did, and I'm just ignorant of her. Like, I have to say, Nathaniel, this was so much fun because you really introduced me to these actresses. I mean, the only two that I knew were Shelley Duvall and Geraldine Page. I didn't really know mm-hmm. about these other actresses, mm-hmm. and I was so happy to sort of be introduced yeah. to them all, which was such a great, like, byproduct of this whole
yeah, project. That's one of the reasons we love doing it.
I know, but I should educate mm-hmm. myself. Mm-hmm. I should educate myself on her career before I judge so harshly.
I thought Susan Tyrell did so many
I want you to be sloppy.
Blab it up.
Eric, did you have an answer to this question?
Not really. I don't know. My brain doesn't kind of think in that way. It's weird. I'm really dumb in those ways. Like, I don't follow, like, deep plots because I just want it to be, like, given to me. Mm-hmm. Or, like, when you're watching, like, a murder mystery or something and everybody in the audience is always like, oh, I knew he did it all along or I thought she did it. I'm not thinking who did it. I'm like, just tell me at the end. It's okay. I don't think in that way.
I always think that way because sometimes I think I missed my calling and I should have been a casting director. Yeah. Like, I'm always thinking of casting and different interpretations that are possible with roles.
But I want to say I love Susan Tyrell. I didn't know anything about her. I never would have watched this movie if I didn't have to, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And, one of the things I was obsessed about is that she goes so far in, like, the blousy drunkenness of it, but yet she adds so many, like, super girlishly feminine elements. Like, I was obsessed when I said that in my write-up, Nathaniel, of, like, the red barrette in the hair the whole time.
So and tragic.
Her clothes are always, like, that yellow polka dot dress that she wears. It's so kind of, like, dainty, and she wears that, like, pink robe, and everything is this very, like, soft little girlish stuff, but she's also this, like, hard woman. And that, I thought, was so beautiful that she put all of that in there. in a way that didn't feel manufactured. It felt like true, that there was always that little girl part of her that hadn't died yet, despite being given so much shit in life. I thought
we didn't really talk about her. Let's talk about her. We didn't talk about Susan Shiro, did we? Not really.
Well, she was the one who got picked.
I do want to say, Donna, I loved what you wrote about her in terms of how hard it is to actually calculate how drunk to be when you're acting.
It's super hard. Yeah. It's like and I'm quite honestly, it's not a strength of mine. So whenever I see actors who really thread that needle of like, you can literally tell how many drinks they've had just by the way they're like sitting or the way they're looking at someone, she's a master. She's a master at it. And
it's really easy to not know your lines when you're playing drunk too. Because if you really are committing to being drunk, like lines truly go away.
Can we talk about her lines though? Like her actual dialogue, if you just listen to what she's saying. It's not awful. It's just very Swiss cheesy. There's just a lot of holes in it. And the fact that she like emotion, like for me, she was my top choice, not only because I thought she was brilliant, but she's also doing like triple duty. She's not only sewing the dialogue together, but she's elevating the dialogue and she's acting on top of it. And she, for me, was sort of doing such a better job than the dudes of pulling that dialogue together and making me believe that those are words that would actually come out of her mouth.
Yeah,
she made. And I just thought, in comparison to the guys, she was clearly handling that script so much better than they were.
Yeah, she made sense of a character that did not make sense on the page.
Exactly.
She made her that person who, like, I know that person. We're like, and I feel that we've all met that person who's like, they're so crazy that, like, they do swing from these huge, from, like, one end to the other within a sentence. And I was also, the one thing that I thought was really great about that movie and her performance in it was that you're clear very early on that she's creating her own reality. So, like, that guy that she's dating, the black guy that she's dating, is actually, she keeps talking about, like, you know, that he's going to, I don't think that character was in jail in the movie. I don't. I think she left for a while and that's what she made up. Just like she would say all the time, like, oh, all these violent mood swings he has. But every time you see him, he's so soft-spoken.
He's the sweetest. He's the sweetest guy.
So I think, like, that to me is genius of her. I really do believe she went away and she was like, oh, we're going to, you know, she plays what's really hard to do and have a translate, which is what real people do, which is she saw the world this way, and that's how she presents it and sees it, and she can't see it any other way. And she clings to that so tightly that you don't know what the truth is with what she's saying. And so those mood swings make sense because she lives in a world that's like constructed all her own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, had to make because she's been given a shit sandwich.
I am going to put Arun on the spot because we put Donna on the spot earlier with Elaine Hecker. Arun, you were the holdout for this performance.
It didn't work for me. I feel bad now. But
don't feel bad.
I had the experience of, I had seen the, I spoke about this in the write-up, but I had seen that the scene where she's in the bar and where Stacey Keach is with her, and it's just the two of them in the bar in the daytime. And I'd seen that before for some reason, and I thought, oh, wow, I was just totally taken up with what she was doing. But then watching the entire film, and what Stacey Keach was doing really worked for me, and I felt like when I saw it in context of the film, tonally, it really didn't work for me. I felt like the film is very clearly in a certain register, and she's playing in such a different key that I felt it felt jarring to me. And actually, for me, it kind of is, Donna, what you were saying about Hecker. For me, this felt like I was watching someone who'd made a bunch of choices, but wasn't always necessarily engaging with what was going on. But for this time, in this film, for some reason, it didn't work for me in the character. So I found it really difficult. And I went back and I watched the scene again, that scene after I'd watched the movie, because I was like, why is it not working? And then out of context, again, it worked for me. But whenever I see it, the whole film, and see her with all the characters and all these other scenes with Bridges and Keach and everybody else, it feels really tonally off to me. And for that reason, I kind of, it, yeah, it, it's
I'm gonna back you up. I'm gonna back you up a little bit. I'm gonna back you up because I think in the panels, and I write a little bit about that too. Like that, I felt like that she was doing some magical stuff, but then tonally things got a little arched for me. Like the director didn't do his job or her his job, right? I'm assuming. Like he didn't. Like there was like something that went too far at times that in a different movie might have been okay, but you're right. In this movie, it felt arched. Yeah,
that's I had that same thing.
But I liked the movie she was in.
Right, but
exactly.
I also
wanted to see her movie.
Yeah, I also think these conversations, both the plus and minuses about her fit with the character, in terms of that character is in a different world than the other characters as well.
Yeah. It's also a weird movie. Like, can you guys explain that movie to me?
I just saw an interview with her in the 90s where she was talking, and she was, I think she did a one-woman show in the 90s where she wrote and performed this one-woman show, and she was being interviewed, and she kind of alludes to that Fat City was a really difficult working experience, and that it was so difficult between her and John Huston that she quit acting. And then she left and she went away and lived in Morocco for 2 years and all of this and kind of went away. And that there was something, she sort of alludes to there's some sort of serious breach of something he said to her. And it does seem like maybe it is clear that there was some very serious tension on that set between the two of them.
Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our conversation. This has been so much fun, but I want to thank everyone again, and I'm going to ask you a farewell question as we say our goodbyes. Thank you to Arun. I want to know what's coming up next for you and what your favorite film of 1972 is. It doesn't need to be one of these five, and it probably isn't.
Oh, yeah, thank God. Coming up next is we're doing another production of my play, The One Who Loves You So, which then goes off to India, and we're in talks about going up to Toronto for a theater festival there. So it's all kind of doing the second wind of this show and then writing new work and working on my first film. So that will be exciting. And my favorite film of 1972, I guess it wasn't eligible for the Oscars that year, but my favorite film of 1972 has to be Cries and Whispers. I think it is. I mean, there's not much that can be said. Ingmar Bergman, it is astonishing in everything. I always think about Ingrid Thulin in that last third. It's just shattering for me. Yeah,
that's the first Bergman I ever saw. I love that one. Yeah, it's masterful. Kathy Dietsch, what's next for you, and what's your favorite?
Sorry, I'm writing down Cries and Whispers. I watch it. I don't know that many movies from the 70s, so this really was such a great introduction. So thank you again for trusting me to be on this and that I would finish my homework. I am a fat activist, and I have a weekly podcast. Actually, it's a vodcast. We do video podcast called Plus This Show, and it's every Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern time. And I have a new co-host, Nikki Bailey, who's really incredible. So we premiere it on May 2nd. I don't know when this will be aired, but after that, it'll be every week at 6. And it lives on Facebook and YouTube, and you can go on SoundCloud and iTunes and find it on podcast form. Also, because I'm not fat enough, I'm doing a sketch comedy group called Fatch. It's all fat women, and we have a monthly residency that happens the fourth Friday of every month at 8 o'clock, and it's hilarious. And we just had our show. That's why I look a little crazy. We just had our show this weekend, and it's such a blast working with these ladies, and we really are bringing a perspective of from the fat lens, which, you know, I think people are getting ready for, especially since 68% of women in America are a size 14 or above. So, yeah, so check us out.
Is that in Los Angeles?
I'm sorry. That is in Los Angeles. Yes, okay. The sketch, the Fatch.
Okay. Yes. And Eric Bloom. Thanks, my friend.
Nothing nearly as cool as these people, but I'm shooting Ryan Reynolds in 2 days, so that'll be nice eye candy. And hopefully he'll be funny. I'm doing a little skit with him. And I've been interviewing to direct a feature, and I'm hoping I get that gig. And if I don't, I'll be writing more for the film experience because I'll have time.
Well, I want you to get it, even though I love having you on the blog. So good luck with that. And what is your favorite film of 1972?
I know it's cliche, but Cabaret is my favorite movie.
That was mine, by the way, too.
It's kind of weird, though, to me. I mean, I also obviously love The Godfather, and it's so weird to have, because I usually think, for me, when the Oscars come up, I'm always much more interested in the acting races than Best Picture, because Best Picture, like this last year, Best Picture, I thought maybe three movies were, like, good, and the rest were, like, eh. So, because it's so, you know, it has to be such a generally loved movie to win that award. And it's just weird to think that The Godfather and Cabaret were both the same year. And, like, yes, Cries and Whispers and The Emigrants, which is such a great movie, and Deliverance.
Yeah.
Like, actually, when you look at those movies, I mean, they're all kind of classics that I feel are earned classics, like are really good movies. So ultimately a really great year. We just didn't get to watch any of those good movies.
I forgot to mention this at the top. This is actually fascinating trivia about this year, and I only discovered it like a week ago. This is the only year in Oscar history, literally the only one, where none of the supporting actress nominees are from Best Picture films.
Oh,
it's literally the only time it's ever happened.
And what is that saying? Can we just talk about like what that's saying for a second? That like the Best Picture movies did not have room for women to be in some sort of supporting capacity, mm-hmm. in a way. Though it's like the indie films or the outside of the box films, right. Like those are the ones that are like, yeah, let's put a chick in there and give her shit to do. That'll be amazing.
Yeah.
It's fascinating that like, you know, the mainstream top five movies of 1972 literally didn't have room mm-hmm. or thought that support woman telling whatever story that was important, which is, mm-hmm. I don't know, just saying it out loud.
So, and finally, Donna Lynn Champlin. I know you just wrapped Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which was such an amazing accomplishment, the whole series.
Thank you.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm enjoying some mommy time, so I'm hanging out with my kid. We are doing two nights at Radio City Music Hall in New York, the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend Live. That's, I think, May. Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be May 14th, May 15th, I believe. I mean, I've got some irons in the fire, which I'm just superstitious, so I don't really.
That's fair.
But, you know, I've got the Radio City thing, and I'm, you know, we're moving back to New York. We've been in L.A. for 4 years, which has been absolutely wonderful and lovely. We've been out here for the show, but it's, you know, it's time for us to go home to New York. I'm going to see you all the time. So that's really what we're focusing on right now, is sort of moving my whole family, including my 7-year-old son, back to New York and getting him reacquainted and in his new school. And so it's a lot of mommy time for me, which I'm loving.
Well, maybe we'll see you back on Broadway then, we can hope.
I would love that. That would make me super happy.
And do you have a favorite film of 72?
Okay, I have to say it is, of course, close with Cabaret, but I actually prefer The Godfather.
Wow.
And Tales from the Crypt, which I believe 1972 was the first one of those. I'm not going to lie, I dig a good Tale from the Crypt, or Tales from the Crypt. I love it. But yeah, no, I love The Godfather, and I love the series, except for the third one, which I think we all agree is a hot mess. But yeah, The Godfather, and then a close second is Cabaret, and then Tales from the Crypt is just like hovering around it, because I love that movie too.
Well, I'm glad we have a lot of Cabaret fans in the house. That is my favorite from the year, but I also love What's Up, Doc.
Me too.
I have never seen What's Up, Doc. All I know is that's the Barbara Streisand one with the hands on her boobs, right?
Which
one is it?
It's the Peter Bogdanovich movie with her and Ryan O'Neal and Madeline Kahn, who totally should have been in this category.
How was she not nominated?
How was Madeline Kahn not nominated?
Madeline Kahn was in a movie in 1972 and she didn't get nominated?
And she's brilliant in it.
She's brilliant in it.
That is annoying.
Extraordinary.
Geraldine Page.
Not okay. Not okay.
We hope everybody enjoyed listening. Next month's event is 2001. We're looking back on that year with Gosford Park, A Beautiful Mind, and other films. And so thanks again to Arun, Kathy, Donna, and Eric.
So nice to meet you.
It was so much fun!